Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The following program is presented under the sponsorship of the Democratic National Committee. A record throng of 60,000 people is assembled at Forbes Field in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania tonight to hear the President of the United States deliver another address in his campaign for re-election. The double-decker stands of the Pittsburgh Ball Club's big stadium, built to seat 38,000, are jammed to capacity, and the thousands of temporary chairs placed on the infield are all filled. People are standing along the sidelines of the big athletic field, all eager to hear President Roosevelt and get a glimpse of him as he speaks. And now, we introduce the chairman of the Pennsylvania State Democratic Committee, the Honorable David L. Lawrence, Secretary of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Mr. Lawrence.
My fellow Pennsylvanians, it is my great privilege at this time to present the President of the United States.
Which will carry his voice to a waiting nation, receiving the enthusiastic cheers of his fellow Americans here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Mr. Chairman, Governor Earl, my friends of Pennsylvania, baseball park is a good place to talk about box scores. And tonight I'm going to talk to you about the box score of the government of the United States. I'm going to tell you the story of our fight to beat down the Depression and win recovery, and where I stand, and from where I stand, it looks as if the game was pretty well in the bag. Convinced that when government finance or any other kind of finance is honest, and when all the cards are on the table, there is no higher mathematics about it. It's just plain scoreboard arithmetic. Now, when the present management of your team took charge in 1933, the national scoreboard looked pretty bad. In fact, it looked so much like a shutout for the team that you voted a change in management in order to give the country a chance to win the game. And today we are winning it. When the new management came to Washington, we began to make our plans to meet the immediate crisis, and plans that would carry the people of the country back to decent prosperity. You and I and everybody else saw millions out of work, saw the business concerns running in the red, saw the banks closing. Our national income had declined over 50%. And what was worse, it showed no prospect of recuperating by itself. By national income, I mean the total of all the income of all 125 million people in this country, the total of all the pay envelopes, all the farm sales, all the profits of all the businesses and all the individuals and all the corporations in America. During the four lean years before this administration took office, that national income that I'm talking about had declined from $81 billion a year to $38 billion a year. In short, you and I, all of us together, were making $41 billion, spelt with a B, not an M, less dollars in 1932 than we had made in 1929. Now, the rise and fall in national income, since it tells the story of how much you and I and everybody else are making, are an index of the rise and fall of national prosperity. It's also an index of the prosperity of your government. The money to run the government comes from taxes, and the tax revenue, in turn, depends for its size on the size of the national income. Thus, when the incomes and the values and the transactions of the country are on the downgrade, then the tax receipts of the government go on the downgrade too. And if the national income continues to decline, then the government cannot run without going into the red. The only way to keep the government out of the red is to keep the people out of the red. And so we had to balance the budget of the American people before we could balance the budget of the national government. That makes common sense, doesn't it? Well, when the box score, when the Democratic administration came in 1933, showed a net deficit in our national accounts of about $3 billion accumulated in the three previous years under my predecessor. National income was on a downward spiral, and federal government revenues were in a downward spiral. To pile vast new taxes would get us nowhere because values were going down, and that makes sense too. And so, on top of having to meet the ordinary expenses of the government, I recognize the obligation of the federal government to feed and take care of the growing army of homeless and destitute unemployed. Something had to be done. We all know that. A national choice had to be made. We could do one of two things. Some people urged me to let nature take its course. Some people urged me to continue a policy of doing nothing. I rejected that advice because nature was in an angry mood. To have accepted that advice would have meant a continued wiping out of people of small means, the continued loss of their homes and farms and small businesses into the hands of people who still had enough capital left to pick up those homes and farms and businesses at bankruptcy prices. It would have meant in a very short time the loss of all the resources of a multitude of individuals and families and small corporations. You would have seen throughout the nation a concentration of property ownership in the hands of 1 or 2% of the population, a concentration unequaled in any great nation since the days of the Roman Empire. And so the program of this administration set out to protect the small business, the small corporation, the small shop, and the small individual from the wave of deflation that threatened them. We realized then, as we do now, that the vast army of small businessmen and factory owners and shop owners form the background, the backbone. They, together with our farmers and workers, the backbone of America. And in our long-range plan, we recognize that the prosperity of America depended upon and would continue to depend upon the prosperity of all of them. I rejected the advice that was given to me to do nothing for an additional reason. I had promised, and my administration was determined, to keep the people of the United States from starvation. Yes, and I refuse to leave human needs solely in the hands of local communities which themselves were almost bankrupt. To have accepted that advice would have been to offer breadlines again to the American people, knowing this time, however, that in many places the lines would last far longer than the bread. And in those dark days, between us and a balanced budget, stood millions of needy Americans denied the promise of a decent American life. To balance our budget in 1933 or 34 or 35 would have been a crime against the American people. To do so, we would either have had to make a capital levy that would have been confiscatory, or we would have had to set our face against human suffering with callous indifference. When Americans suffered, we refused to pass by on the other side. Humanity came first. Now, my friends, nobody with any sense of responsibility lightly lays a burden on the income of a nation. But this vicious tightening circle of our declining national income had to be broken. The bankers and the industrialists of the nation cried aloud that private business was powerless to break it. They turned, as they had a right to turn, to the government itself. And we accepted the final responsibility of government after all else had failed. Responsibility to spend money when no one else had money left to spend. I adopted, therefore, the other alternative. I cast aside the do-nothing or wait-and-see policy. As a first step in our program, we had to stop the quick spiral of deflation, the spiral of the decline in the national income. And having stopped them, we went on to restore purchasing power, to raise values, to put people back to work, and to start the national income going up again. Yes, in 1933, we reversed the policy of the previous administration. For the first time since the Depression, you had a Congress and an administration in Washington that had the courage to provide the necessary resources which private interests no longer had or no longer dared to risk. This cost money. We know, and you know, in March 1933, that it would cost money. We know, and you know, that it would cost money for several years to come. The people understood that in 1933. They understood it in 1934 when they gave the administration a full endorsement of its policy. They knew it in 1935, and they know in 1936 that the plan is working. All right, my friends, let's look at the cost. Since we could not get the money by taxes, and ought not to have got it by taxes in those years, we borrowed it, and we increased the public debt. President Hoover's administration increased the debt in the net amount of over $3 billion in three Depression years, and there was little to show for it. My administration has increased the national debt in the net amount of $8 billion, and there is much to show for it. Now, let's take that figure of $8 billion out here on the scoreboard, and let me tell you where the dollars went. Over $1.5 billion went for the payment of the World War Veterans Bonus this year instead of 1945. That payment is now out of the way and is no longer a future obligation of the government. As for the other $6.5 billion, we didn't just spend money. We spent money for something. America got something for what it spent. The conservation of human resources through CCC camps, through work relief, conservation of natural resources of water, soil, and forest. Billions for security and a better life. And remember that while many who criticize today were selling America short, we were investing in the future of America. Contrast those expenditures and what we got for them with certain other expenditures of the American people in the years between 1920 and 1930. During that period, not merely 8 billions, but many more billions, about 14 billions, came out of American pockets and were sent abroad to foreign countries, where the money was used for increasing foreign armaments, for building foreign factories to compete with us, for building foreign dwellings, swimming pools, slaughterhouses, for giving employment to the foreign unemployed, foreign boondoggling, if you like it. Now those dollars, 14 billion of them, were just as good American money, just as hard earned, just as much the reward of thrift as the dollars that we've spent these past 3 years at home giving work to the unemployed. But most of those dollars that went abroad, why, they're gone for good. Those billions lost to us under previous administrations do not, by the way, include the other billions loaned by the United States to foreign governments during and immediately after the war. And so I ask you the simple question, hasn't it been a sounder investment for us during these past 3 years to spend $8 billion for American industry, American farms, American homes, and the care of American citizens? Now, my friends, I've used that figure of $8 billion as representing the net increase in our national debt. And immediately, people will rush into print or run to the microphone to tell you that my arithmetic is all wrong. They will tell you that the increase in the national debt is 13 billion instead of 8. Now, that is technically and morally just as correct as if someone were to try to scare you about the condition of your bank by telling you all about its liabilities and not telling you about its assets. And that is technically and morally just as correct as telling you good people in Pennsylvania that none of your bank deposits or insurance policies are any good. When you are told that the United States Treasury has 13 billion more of liabilities than it had in 1933, you should also be told that it has $6 billion of increased assets to set off against those liabilities. Yes, in 3 years our net national debt has increased $8 billion, but in 2 years of the recent war, it increased as much as $25 billion. National defense. National defense and the future of America were involved in 1917 and 18. National defense and the future of America were also involved in 1933. Don't you believe that the saving of America has been cheap at that price? And incidentally, my friends, tonight is an anniversary in the affairs of your government that I want to celebrate with you and the American people. It is October 1st, and it marks the end of a whole year in which there has not been a single national bank failure in all the United States. Wait, it's been 55 years, not 12 long years, but 55 years since that kind of a record has been established. You and I can take this occasion to rejoice in that record. It is proof that the program has worked. Compare the scoreboard that you have in Pittsburgh now with the scoreboard that you had when I stood here at second base in this field 4 years ago. At that time, as I drove through these great valleys, I could see mile after mile of mill, the greatest mill and factory area in the world. A dead panorama of silent black structures and smokeless stacks. I saw idleness and hunger instead of the whirl of machinery. And today, as I came north from West Virginia, I saw mines operating. I found bustle and life, the hiss of steam, the ring of steel on steel, the roaring song of industry. And now one word in closing about this foolish fear, about the crushing load the debt will impose on your children and mine. This debt is not going to be paid by oppressive taxation on future generations. It's not going to be paid by taking away the hard-won savings of the present generation. It is going to be paid out of an increased national income and increased individual income produced by increasing national prosperity. The truth is, looking back over these years, that we are doing better than we anticipated in 33. The national income has gone up faster than we dared then to hope. Deficits have been less than we expected. Treasury receipts are increasing. And incidentally, the national debt today in relation to the national income is much less than it was in 1933 when this administration took office. One word more. They're simple figures. Keep them in the front of your head. The national income in 1932 was $38 billion. In 1935, it was $53 billion. And this year, it will be well over $60 billion. If it keeps on rising at the present rate, as I am confident it will, the receipts of the government without imposing any additional taxes will within a year or two be sufficient to care for all ordinary and relief expenses of the government, in other words, to balance the budget. The government of this great nation, solvent, sound in credit, is coming through a crisis as grave as war, coming through without having sacrificed American democracy or the ideals of American life.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States in the second of his formal political addresses in this campaign for re-election.